Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei said that enemies have been trying to advance their malicious political agenda by waging an economic war against the Iranian nation. Reports emerging of U.S. forces transferring hundreds of Daesh terrorists from a prison in northeast Syria to a desert near Iraq's border. The UK says it will offer NATO a major deployment of forces and weapons in Eastern Europe over what it calls Russian hostility. Good day, everyone. Welcome to World News here in the Iranian capital. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Good to have you with us. Now, Iran's leader says the enemies have been seeking to advance their political plots against Iran through an economic war. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei says an economic collapse was a prelude to wicked political goals. According to the leader, enemies sought to pit the Iranian nation against the Islamic establishment. He also said that Iran's economy should not be tied to issues over which officials have no control. The leader made a comment during an address to a group of Iranian manufacturers. Now, fresh reports emerging of the U.S. role in northeastern Syria. American forces have transferred 750 Daesh terrorists, most of them foreigners, from a prison in Hasakah province. Russian media are quoting special sources as saying that the detainees have been transferred to a desert in Deir al-Zor province. They say that U.S. coalition drones perform monitoring the operation to secure their exit route until they arrive at their destination near the town of Bukema. The transfer process took place in batches by SUVs and buses. A number of top Daesh leaders who hold Arab, Belgian, and Dutch nationalities were among the escapees. Last week, Daesh attacked the detention center. Heavy fighting ensued. Kurdish-led forces were allies of the U.S. and fighting the Syrian government around the prison. Syria's UN envoy has blamed Washington for the clashes. Bassam Sabak says that the U.S. is seeking to recycle Daesh and justify American military presence in Syria. So for some more information and insight, let's cross over to Damascus. So Mohammed Ali, our correspondent, is there. Mohammed, what do you have for us?
Yes, according to Russian media reports, the U.S. Forces in Al-Hasakah area northeast of Syria took advantage of the chaos that happened when Daesh attacked last week a prison called Vuhran in Al-Hasakah governorate and transported 750 Daesh terrorists out from there and transported them towards an area near El Bukamal on the borderline with Iraq. In details, of course, we saw the reports issued by Russian media that according to their sources, what happened was that the so-called Syria's Democratic Forces retreated from three positions around that prison, which was attacked by Daesh, to ensure a safe escape for the terrorists. They gathered in two positions in Al-Hasakah, and then they were transported out. Of course, according to the reports, reconnaissance drones of the U.S.-led coalition ensured and gave all the facilities possible to those terrorists, directing them how to move and which roads and ways to use in order to reach that area in Deir al-Zor's southern countryside near El Bukamal and also El Bishri Mountain. And what that means, it means that Daesh is transporting those terrorists to areas where the Syrian army has been for years with its allies fighting Daesh terrorists. And this, according to analysts, shows the destructive role of the United States in Syria, and it shows that the United States is just using the pretext of fighting Daesh in order to keep occupying parts of Syria. And this is definitely not the first time that Russia refers to the cooperation between the United States and Daesh. Previously, Russia noted that Daesh is actually training that the United States is actually training Daesh terrorists in the base that it's occupying in El Tanf area on the borderline with Iraq. And just a week ago, last week, the Syrian military prosecution also said it had evidence of the United States training Daesh and facilitating their movement in the Syrian desert near El Tanf. So they have evidence seeing them moving around inside that base freely. And also, we have to point out that all of the U.S.-led coalition airstrikes never defeated Daesh, which has puts a lot of question marks on if Daesh is actually in the first place even trying to defeat that terrorist organization.
All right, thanks for that. Mohammed Ali, correspondent in Damascus. Now, speaking of Syria, the government there has initiated a reconciliation process for towns and villages in southern Damascus countryside. And this is an implementation of the state's strategy to restore peace and normal life to areas that previously witnessed violence across the country. Our correspondent has more.
Cheering for Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, thousands of locals in southern Damascus welcomed high-ranking security officers who arrived in Kiswe town to initiate a reconciliation process that would lead to providing amnesty to those wanted by security apparatus during the crisis and implementation of presidential amnesty decrees.
There's an amnesty decree by President Bashar al-Assad today to start a reconciliation campaign in the countryside. Tomorrow, the campaign will cover all Damascus countryside for all misled Syrians. The importance of such a campaign is its contribution in restoring peace.
We conveyed the demands of the people in Damascus countryside for reconciliation to President Assad, who ordered the formation of a security committee that includes the military prosecution and all security apparatus to solve the problems of the people and settle their situation.
Hundreds of wanted people flocked to reconciliation centers to settle their situation. Some had escaped military duty, while others were involved in anti-government acts or were members of armed groups in the past.
We were outlaws. We came to reconcile. We were misled like many Syrians. Everyone makes mistakes. We came today to be on the right track with our homeland thanks to President Assad.
This is the most comprehensive reconciliation deal south of the capital. Over 2,700 individuals had reconciled in southern Damascus since 2016. Thousands more currently have the chance to return to normal life in the next week. The Syrian government has for years prioritized reconciliation deals over military solutions in areas that have witnessed violence throughout the unrest. Such deals lay the foundation for a negotiated settlement of the crisis facing the country. Hamad Ali, Damascus countryside.
Israeli President Yitzhak Herzog is set to land in the UAE for talks with leaders of the Arab country. That's the first such trip by an Israeli president. Herzog will be meeting top Emirati officials, including Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed. The UAE, along with Bahrain, established diplomatic relations with Israel 2 years ago in U.S. broker deals. Palestinians regard normalization as a stab in their back. Israeli media is saying that Herzog will use his two-day stay to encourage more Persian Gulf Arab nations to normalize relations with Tel Aviv. The trip follows another one by Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett in December. Now, the Iranian president says his country has proven its will and seriousness in the talks aimed at reviving the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA. Ibrahim Raisi says the verifiable removal of anti-Iran sanctions will provide the basis for an agreement. He says the other negotiating parties must provide guarantees that they won't withdraw from the pact in the future. Raisi made a comment in a phone call with his French counterpart. Emmanuel Macron said Iran has the right to distrust the U.S., as it was Washington that threw the JCPOA in disarray. He was referring to the unilateral withdrawal of the U.S. from the deal in 2018. Iran, the remaining parties have been trying to revive the agreement. Britain, France, and Germany say the talks are in their final stages and that political decisions need to be made now. Well, we've talked to author and journalist Robert Fantina for his take on efforts to resurrect the Iran 2015 agreement. The Ontario-based analyst says that the U.S. needs to show good faith to help bring the tattered deal back to life.
With these latest remarks, and the fact that the other signatories are saying that it's time for political decisions and that, as you said, we're entering a new phase, it is time to conclude this. But the conclusion will come about when the United States decides to remove all the sanctions before Iran makes any efforts to reduce its nuclear enrichment, because it is the United States that violated the agreement. Those are the political decisions that must be made on the part of the U.S. and the part of the other signatories. Part of Iran's major concern is having an assurance that the United States will not once again unilaterally withdraw, and yet members of the U.S. Congress are saying they're going to do exactly that. So the U.S., if it wants to reinstate the JCPOA, which around the world was considered a positive agreement, there are going to have to be some major concessions by the United States to show its good faith. The government of Iran has already showed its good faith and goodwill by maintaining the agreement for a full year afterwards. The United States has done nothing but show bad faith, and it's proven that it cannot be trusted.
The UK is planning to commit more forces and weapons to the NATO alliance for deployment in Eastern Europe amid rising tensions with Russia over Ukraine. Prime Minister Boris Johnson says that the move will send a clear message to the Kremlin that London won't tolerate what it described as Moscow's destabilizing activities. The offer will be made to NATO military chiefs next week. The deployment will include warships, jets, and military equipment. Britain may also double its forces in Eastern Europe countries from the current 1,150. Relations between Russia and the West have been at their lowest point since the Cold War. NATO insists that Russia has deployed tens of thousands of troops on the border in preparation for an invasion of Ukraine. Moscow said it has the right to move forces on its own soil because its security is at risk from NATO's eastward enlargement and military activity. Well, like you just heard, crisis over Ukraine keeps unraveling amid a standoff between the U.S.-led NATO and Russia. Washington has already sent several batches of military supplies to Kiev. It's now planned to dispatch troops to Eastern Europe. Several of U.S. allies have also put their forces on alert over what they call a possible Russian invasion of Ukraine. Meantime, corporate media portraying Moscow as an aggressor while ignoring how the West has been threatening Russian security with military drills and weapons buildup near its borders. Let's now take a look at Portugal, where polling stations have opened in the snap legislative elections. The vote is called in was called in November after Parliament rejected the socialist government's budget bill. It's being held as the ruling socialists continue to lose their lead in opinion polls for the main opposition party, the center-right Social Democrats. But politics aside, the ballot is taking place amid fears of a spread of the COVID, with the country reporting record-breaking daily cases. Over a million people are in isolation due to COVID. However, the government has announced that those infected are allowed to leave their homes to vote. Strict health protocols remain in place to ensure the safety of the voters. Now, Sergio Mattarella has been re-elected as Italian president, ending a week of political squabbling among party leaders. His acceptance to stay for a second mandate has pulled the country out of a quagmire that would otherwise erode the government's credibility. We have a report.
Mattarella. Mattarella.
After 6 days of failed votes and 8 rounds of ballots, on Saturday the Italian parliament re-elected 80-year-old Sergio Mattarella as president of the republic with 759 votes out of 983 cast by the grand electors. In the days ahead of the election, Mattarella, who has been in office since 2015, had repeatedly said that he didn't want another stint. However, he changed his mind on Saturday afternoon when the leaders of parliamentary groups resorted to him in a desperate attempt to put an end to a political impasse that would erode the nation's credibility.
I was expecting him to win. He is a beacon of reliability and balance.
At the beginning of the election, I would have never guessed it. But when Draghi's chances to be elected started to appear slim, I realized that Mattarella could be the one.
The political stalemate was triggered by parties' disagreement over the candidacy of Prime Minister Draghi to be the next president earlier in the week. In the following days, parties struggled to reach an agreement over an alternative figure, dragging the country on the verge of a political crisis. Commentators have slammed political leaders for their bickering over a consensus candidate. Some have said that not even during a pandemic crisis which has brought the country to its knees, political parties have been able to put aside their differences.
Politicians squandered a huge amount of time amid divisions and rivalries to get back to square one with Mattarella as president and Draghi as prime minister. 8 rounds of balloting have left deep scars with potentially dangerous repercussions for political stability. I'm expecting some ministers to be replaced.
Prime Minister Draghi is expected to reshuffle his cabinet as his first move following Mattarella's election. He has to make sure that the 260 billion euros that Italy is receiving from the European Recovery Fund to counter the economic fallout of the COVID-19 crisis are spent effectively. Draghi has committed to 58 reforms and 132 investments over the next 5 years. Max Civili, Rome.
Social anger over a mandatory COVID vaccination has raged Canada, with thousands of people turning out in Ottawa to protest the mandates announced by Prime Minister Trudeau. The march started as a truckers' protest against obligatory vaccination for entering to the U.S., but the city's residents later joined the convoy and marched on Parliament. The protest was held amid tight security triggered by violent rhetoric that the promoters used on social media. The reports that Trudeau and his family were moved to a secure location from their downtown Ottawa home. 77% of Canada's population has received two jabs. That includes 90% of its truckers. Canada made vaccination mandatory for federal workers in October. A similar mandate was jointly announced with the U.S. for cross-border truckers last month. There has been renewed violence in Kashmir, where Indian troops have killed five pro-independence fighters. Two operations took place south of Srinagar overnight. Police say the top commander from the so-called JJ Muhammad group was among those killed. In January alone, 21 pro-independence fighters were killed across the Indian-controlled Kashmir. Last year, the disputed region witnessed a wave of unrest, to which the Indian forces responded with a widespread crackdown. Nearly 190 pro-independence fighters were killed. The conflict started after the partition of India in 1947, with both India and Pakistan claiming the entirety of Kashmir. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
I'm Eric Shumanandi from India.
I was born actually in London, England.
I'm a journalist by profession.
I'm 20 years old and I'm a student of the sex. My dad, who taught me the art of
life. Listeners Special.
In the name of God, the compassionate, the merciful. Salam, dear listeners, and warmest greetings to you all. Welcome to this week's edition of Listeners Special of this beautiful Sunday, January 30, 2022. I'm Atefa Erfani, hosting this program today. Listeners Special is the Sunday program where your views are presented through emails, letters, messages from around the world. So please contact us and tell us what you think about our broadcast. If you have any messages for our listeners around the world, then you can record your voice, send it to us, and get your voice heard in this program. Please do remember, Listeners Special is your program. It's your views that are important. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, and as usual, many of you have taken the trouble of sending us reception reports. These reception reports are very helpful to us, especially to our engineers and technicians at IRIB English Radio. These reception reports actually enable us to provide a better service to our great listeners around the world. All of you who have sent in a reception report will be receiving an EQSL card from us. So here, I truly appreciate those of our great listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports, including Pritam Bhakat from India, Heikki Puranen from Finland, and Olof Ratuvara from Finland. I wish I'm right in pronouncing your name, Olof. So, Olof, Pritam, and Heikki, we want you to know how much we value your support and commitment to IRIB English Radio. And as usual, we've received so many emails from around the world, including an email from Bangladesh from Abu Sayed, one of our regular listeners, an email from Igor Belevich from Belarus, again, one of our old and regular listeners. And here we have an email from Arthur Fernandez Lorella from Spain, one of our regular listeners. And here we have an email from Lithuania from Thomas Biliaskas, one of our old and regular listeners. And the last but not the least is an email from Italy from Carlo Giordani. Please stay with us. Later during the program, I will read these great emails from around the world. Please stay with me. Welcome back. Abu Sayed from Bangladesh has sent us an email. Let's see what Abu Sayed tells us in his email. Dear friends at IRIB English Radio, greetings from Bangladesh. We are old listeners of IRIB English Service. We have had the chance to visit your website and listen to your programs regularly. We are looking forward to writing to you again and again, and I hope we can deepen the relationship with you and get in touch with you more than before. I would be very happy to receive you, to receive a calendar and some souvenirs for our club in the new year. First of all, salam and greetings from Iran, from IRIB English Radio to you, Abu Sayed from Bangladesh, one of our old and regular listeners. We are so happy that you're writing to your radio, IRIB English Radio. That's such a great email. We are also looking forward to hearing from you again and again. And we hope that this mutual relationship deepens and deepens with you getting in touch with us and you receiving the most updated news and different programs of IRIB English Radio. My colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. Sending you calendar and souvenirs of IRIB English Radio, the promotional items of our radio, is not possible in time of pandemic. God willing, after this pandemic, we will send you, of course, IRIB English Radio souvenirs. Abu Sayed from Bangladesh, many thanks for sending us this great email. Write to us soon. And from Belarus, we have an email from Igor Belevich, one of our regular listeners. Let's see what Igor says. Hello again, IRIB English Radio. Please accept my greetings from the snowy Belarus. I am glad to announce that I have become one of the regular listeners of your radio in English, which I listen to on shortwave, as well as your Russian radio on medium wave. I love Iran and its culture as an old civilization in the world. Hope to hear from you more. Salam and Warm greetings to you from Iran to the snowy Belarus. Thank you very much for writing this email to your radio, IRIB English Radio. So, you are passing snowy days in Belarus, of course. In Iran, we had the snowy days, but not right now at the time we are airing this program. But we had some snowy days since the beginning of winter in Iran, and that was great. So, you have become one of our regular listeners. One of the regular listeners of IRIB English Radio, and you also listen to Russian radio, Russian IRIB service on the medium wave, and that's great. You both listen to two of these radio stations of Iran, both of them belonging to IRIB, and that's great. So, if you love Iran and its rich culture as an old civilization in the world, you can follow our cultural programs. Yes, we broadcast different cultural programs at IRIB English Radio. You can follow them. And the archives of these programs are also available at our website at www.parstoday.com/en. And then you can enjoy them. Yes, IRIB is the only reliable source to know about the real image of Iran. Thank you for writing this email to us, Igor Blevich from Belarus. Write to us soon, and we are looking forward to hearing from you. Well, dear listeners, after a short break, I will be back with other emails from around the world. Welcome back. This is Listeners Special, your program. And from Spain, we have an email from Artur Fernandez Lorella, one of our old and regular listeners. Artur says, "Dear staff, thank you very much for your kind reply to my previous email. We are all fine here, despite coronavirus pandemic and all terrible problems ensuing that. I hope you are all fine there in Tehran too. I will be glad to receive a QSL or EQSL from you. I am sending an old reception report. Would it be possible to confirm it with your EQSL, please? Thanks a lot in advance for your help and your nice programs. Stay healthy." Salam and warm greetings to you, Artur Fernandez Lorella from Spain. And many thanks for sending us this great email. Of course, my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. Be sure about that. And thank you very much for your greetings. We are all fine in Tehran and in Iran because the majority of people are all vaccinated with the booster dose. So we are all fine, thank you. And I hope everything gets fine in your region and around the world regarding the pandemic. Thanks a lot for writing this email to us. Write to us soon. We're looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Artur Fernandez Lorella from Spain. And Thomas Biliaskas, one of our regular listeners, also has sent us an email. Thomas says, "Dear IRIB, I am a shortwave radio listener, and I would like to send you next reception report of your broadcast. However, it was difficult to listen because of weak signal and large amount of atmospheric noise. I tried several times to listen to your English and other languages programs, and it was the same. So, I have to say it is very difficult to listen to your broadcast, especially at winter time. I continue to follow the events of your country, and I'm wishing all the best for you." Salam and warmest greetings to you, Thomas Viliaskas from Lithuania, and I do express my appreciations to you for sending us this email. despite the troubles you had with the noise. You said it was a large amount of atmospheric noise and the weak signal. Thank you very much for writing this email to your radio, IRIB English Radio. We wish you all the best. Of course, we will inform our engineers and technicians about these problems you reported, and my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation. Don't forget to tell us your views about our programs. Write to us soon. We are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. Thomas Viliauskas from Lithuania. And after a short break, I will be back with other emails from around the world. Please stay with us. Welcome back. I think we have enough time to read an email from Carlo Giordani from Italy. Carlo says, glad to hear from you again. I'm still listening to IRIB English Radio. I'd be very happy to receive a QSL card from your site. Tonight, I had the pleasure to listen to your programs, and I really enjoyed that. Salam, ciao, and warm greetings to you, Carlo Giordani from Italy. I do express my appreciations to you for sending us this great message. So, you listened to IRIB English radio programs and you enjoyed it. Thank you very much for reflecting your views about our programs. And my colleagues will soon send you an EQSL card as a confirmation to this great email. So, Carlo Giordani from Italy, we are looking forward to hearing from you very soon. And time tells me we have to skip to the next section of our program, which is this week's interview, which is conducted with one of our regular listeners. Please take a listen.
Yeah, you're welcome. I think your news coverage is useful because you cover news that other international broadcasters often don't, such as the BBC or the Voice of America. You cover information, especially about your region and the Middle East, which is very useful. I don't think there's much in the way of improvement as I can particularly think of. You're putting in a good signal. What I would say is that it's good that you've remained on shortwave. Now, a lot of international broadcasters have abandoned shortwave for the internet and thereby losing, I would think, a lot of their listeners, and international broadcasting is very important because it helps nations to cooperate and helps people from different countries to be friendly, etc. I'm one of those old-fashioned people that doesn't use the internet, surprisingly. I often get told off by my friends because I'm not on the internet, but no, it's far more exciting. No, I mean, you have to agree that the quality of reception, obviously, on the internet is better than shortwave, but shortwave is very exciting. You're actually receiving a signal that's come from hundreds or thousands of miles away and has been sent by a transmitting antenna and bounced off the ionosphere. And although the signal may fade a bit and you might get a bit of noise, it's far more exciting and interesting to listen on shortwave than on the internet. But my message is keep listening to IRRD on shortwave. Keep listening, keep in contact with the stations, keep sending them reception reports because they are valuable to the technical staff of these stations and that they'd like to know that their signal is getting through. And they like listener response because they want to know there are people who are actually out there listening. Thanks very much.
welcome back. Before we wrap up this week's edition of Listeners Special, I do express my appreciations to those of our listeners who have kindly sent us reception reports and emails, including Olof Ratuvara from Finland, Pritam Bahakat from India, Heki Puranin from Finland, Igor Belevich from Belarus, Abu Sayed from Bangladesh, Carlo Giordani from Italy, Thomas Biliaskas from Lithuania, and Arthur Fernandez Lorella from Spain. Please keep in touch with your radio, IRIB English Radio, and have a good time. Goodbye.
Listeners, your opinion is always important to us. We invite you to spend just a few minutes writing us a letter or sending us an email. We'll be glad to hear from all of our listeners who have any questions or comments about any of our programs. Our postal address is IRIB English Service, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. You can also send your emails to EnglishRadio@irib.ir. That is one word, EnglishRadio@irib.ir. Please visit our website at www.pasttoday.com/en. Our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Once again, our phone number is 00981-2201-3720. Our profile is also in Facebook. Our address is www.facebook.com/pasttodayenglish. Thank you all for being with IRIB English Radio.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
When it comes to the standoff between the U.S. and NATO with Russia over Ukraine, there seems to be a key development that changes the dynamics. Now Ukraine has come out and said that the U.S. in particular is hyping the situation and has elevated to a war scenario. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why the U.S. is taking a more aggressive stance against Russia and whether the U.S. reluctance to not meet Russia's security demands will end up in a war or not.
Ukraine, a country in Eastern Europe, making the headlines these days as it remains a source of friction between its neighbor Russia and backers in the U.S.-led NATO alliance. Corporate media have been trying to portray Russia as an aggressor, bombarding their audience with reports on the country's troop deployment at the border, its military drills, as well as moving blood supplies to Ukraine. Can the international community fall into yet another war trap in a scenario set by the West on a likely Russian invasion of Ukraine? But the question is, given the US-led NATO's eastward expansion and transfer of their lethal weapons and troops bases in Eastern Europe, which one is the real aggressor, NATO or Russia?
When the Soviet Union fell and the Warsaw Pact had already been ended, since then, NATO has added 14 more countries, and nearly all of them are countries that were either republics of the Soviet Union or allies of the Soviet Union.
Ukraine is simply a pawn on the Western chessboard. The U.S. has already sent several consignments of weapons as part of a multi-million-dollar security aid to Ukraine while planning more troop deployment. America's allies, Britain, France, and others, have also put their forces on alert. The massive propaganda has even prompted the Ukrainian leader to urge his Western counterparts to avoid stirring panic over a Russia invasion. The West claims Russia is building up troops at the border to invade Ukraine. Moscow denies any such plan, saying its troop mobilization is simply defensive. It says the buildup also aims to counter NATO aggression. The military alliance has conducted several war games near Russian borders, three of them jointly with Ukraine, which is not even a member of the military alliance. So, what's the real game plan? Analysts believe the U.S. wants to integrate Ukraine into the American empire by granting it a NATO membership, a message hidden in Washington's response to Moscow's security proposals.
This makes the Russians see red spots before their eyes, the same way as any talk of Mexico, say, joining a Chinese military alliance would make them freak out in Washington. It's not a difficult problem.
Russia is seen to reassert its place in the international arena, and its proposals for a diplomatic resolution to the Ukraine standoff seem reasonable. A possible military conflict between the European Union and Russia would entail massive human losses and economic harms. Undoubtedly, Russia has grown increasingly concerned about its security because of Western weapons and forces deployed to its doorstep. The corporate media have played a vital part in fueling tensions, and the U.S., that has waged numerous wars overseas, knows very well how dangerous provoking a war with Russia will be.
Our guest joining us for this edition of the Spotlight, representative to the U.N. from the Schiller Institute, Richard Black, joins us from Hackensack, New Jersey. We also have radio host, journalist, and political activist Don DeBar, who joins us from Ossining, New York.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to you both. Don DeBar, first to you. You have the U.S. pretty familiar with the stance of the U.S. at this point, very pro-militaristic in nature, 8,500 troops on heightened alert. They have told Ukraine, we're going to keep giving you arms. They just delivered, I don't know how many hundreds of tons of arms based on the latest report. And then you had the Ukrainian pro-war president that I'm going to take on Russia changing stance. Of which his latest quote was, he said, stop creating panic. And he said, we don't need this panic. What is going on here? Is there a change of stance from the Ukrainian president?
It's hard to parse what things are real and what things are for public consumption, because there's a great deal of both moving parts in play right now. You have a pronouncement from Lukashenko, he's basically playing the same role that the Ukrainian president is playing, you know, let me at him, hold me back, in other words, you have two paper tiger, mad dogs that are your proxy, a 21st century version of Yugoslavia and Albania when the Soviet Union and the People's Republic of China would have a public dispute. These would be their proxies. First, in terms of all the things that are going on, who's their hostilities and what's going on. There's satellites, networks in the possession of both sides of this that they've been using for 50 years now. They know exactly who has what resources deployed where. So you have a discussion, for example, where people say, okay, well, if they're going to put the troop, U.S. and NATO are going to put troops in Ukraine, and they're going to try to foment color revolutions, quote unquote, in Belarus and Kazakhstan, and you look at a map and it starts to look like Operation Barbarossa, because that's true, by the way. You look at a map of the fullest extent of the Nazi invasion in the early 1940s and where NATO is now and where they're trying to go, they'd be starting Hitler's invasion from the front lines instead of from Germany, which is the Russian strategists are well aware of this.
Uh-huh.
So people say, well, suppose they put resources in Cuba, Venezuela, Nicaragua,
right,
and then the United States, there's a huge outcry, we will not allow that to be severe consequences. Well, and then you have from Lavrov and Putin a statement that we are now reaching deeper relations, economic, social, political, and military, vague. So that stuff is for public consumption. The United States knows exactly where every piece of Russian and Chinese military equipment on the planet is, as do they know where every piece of NATO, et cetera. So there's a real game that's going on between the two militaries and intelligence agencies and
right,
the deep government in the case. And then there's this TV show we're watching. It's hard to parse which is which.
But one of the things that Richard Black, Don DeBar said there is the fact that how Ukraine can be, in a sense, a proxy for the U.S. I mean, we know that there was a color revolution that happened in Ukraine, but we're looking at how just in the past days the Ukrainian president has changed stance. Another one of his quotes, Ukraine's stability is of great significance. And he said U.S. is panic triggering alerts are placing a heavy burden on the economy. It seems like there's a diversion. Do you think there is one?
Yes, it is the case that President Zelensky has made the point repeatedly in the last days that certain forces in the West, typified by CNN, Truss of Britain, and others, are talking about an imminent invasion of Ukraine by Russia, which does not exist. The Ukrainian leadership keeps saying it does not exist. The Russian leadership has said it does not exist. So something very nasty and dangerous is coming out from what we had identified since the days of President Eisenhower as the military-industrial complex in the West. Today, Britain calls itself Global Britain and is pushing the pouring of weapons into Ukraine like mad. But step back a second. First of all, NATO became obsolete in 1991 when the Soviet Union disbanded. And what is required, the solution, is a new security architecture involving all of Europe, based on the principles of the Treaty of Westphalia of 1648, which ended massive religious warfare in Europe. The principle of diplomacy in a seemingly intractable situation is nations acting for the benefit of the other. I don't believe that President Biden wants a war with Russia. The American people don't want a war with Russia. And it's imperative that the United States...
What does he want, then? What does he want when you say that? When you say Biden doesn't want a war with Russia, what does he want? Because it sure smells like one.
Not necessarily. If you look at the transcripts and the videos, the media continually attempts to goad him make provocative statements against Russia, and he keeps saying, we'll see a little bit, I'm not sure. I want to stress to you that there are significant forces in the United States, typified by former Ambassador Matlock to Russia, former Ambassador Chas Freeman to Saudi Arabia, former CIA Chief Graham Fuller in Afghanistan, who have all been calling very, very loudly and vociferously for a pullback of the U.S. offensive against Russia and calling for accepting the very recent proposals of the Russian Federation. Similarly, in Europe, many nations and leaders are saying this has to be slowed down.
Okay, let's get into that. I was going to get into that a little bit later, but Don DeBar, you had this interesting document which the U.S. decided not to release the details. It's very confusing as to the way that the U.S. approached this, not wanting to make it public, and for Russia to make parts of it public. But basically, I don't know if you saw that press conference where you had the U.S. Secretary of State presenting this document and saying, we're offering Russia a roadmap. But it sounded like it was a roadmap for the U.S. and not for Russia, because none of Russia's demands were met. But, of course, he didn't want to come out and say that, Anthony Blinken. At the same time, he was very vociferous when it came to how much weapons they're giving Ukraine, how their allies, U.S. allies in the Baltic states, for example, that are going to be getting more weapons. It's almost as if the U.S. had the gun down Russia's throat, saying, if you don't follow what we are proposing, then this is what you're going to get. Did you get that impression?
Well, I saw the press conference. What he delivered was a reply document from the United States. There was one also that came from NATO. There were reply documents to a pair of proposals, again, one to the United States and one to NATO, that Russia delivered on December 17th of this past year. And it wasn't a roadmap. He used the word roadmap here, from Blinken's mouth. I'm thinking of this image from the Johnny Carson show when they used to say a fake commercial, meet at the fork of the road, and there'd be an actual fork and then a bunch of squiggly lines behind it, a map that was useless to anyone trying to go anywhere. Russia laid out very plainly what the concerns are that they have, that they would like to negotiate a settlement, basically a global settlement with the United States and NATO, that you promised not to move your alliance up to our doorstep, in fact, not to even take military equipment into Eastern Germany at that time, East Germany, let alone into the Warsaw Pact countries, Poland, Czechoslovakia, the whole lot of them, Romania, Bulgaria. And so what happened instead was not only did they take most of the, and this was a point for Blinken, that someone misspoke on a TV show on RT and said practically all instead of saying most, but almost every member of the Warsaw Pact is now a member of NATO, along with the three Baltic states, Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia, and some other Soviet republics. And then on top of that, you had an attempted coup in each of Belarus and Kazakhstan that are clearly tied to the CIA. I mean, there's been millions, and there was $5 billion, according to Victoria Nuland from the U.S. State Department, Assistant Secretary of State for European Affairs, that was spent in the lead up to the Maidan coup, basically developing the communications infrastructure, including three TV stations that were used during the. This kind of thing has been going on in all of the old Soviet republics around Russia and in East Europe. And so Russia is seeing this, and they're seeing the troops that they fought when Germany invaded, rolling in with being greeted by the locals, realizing the troops are being placed there for them.
Well, what's interesting about Richard Black, is the fact that in some cases we're looking at a Europe that has been somewhat conspicuously absent from the talks. I mean, remember the talks the week before where you had Wendy Sherman doing the negotiations with the Russian envoy at that point, and then there were news that it was the U.S. that was making the bidding for Europe, but not all European countries are on board. Why is it that Europe is not present, not actively present, when it comes to the talks?
Well, it is absolutely the case that there's a process that has emerged in Europe in which within many of NATO countries, the answer to war with Russia over Ukraine is absolutely no. Croatia has said we will not send troops. The Hungarian foreign minister is saying we need to negotiate long-term energy deals with Russia. Macron just had a long conversation yesterday with President Putin. President Putin just had a seminar with leading Italian industrialists earlier in the week, and a new one is being set up between German industrialists who want peace with Russia, a new video conference with President Putin. So in fact, it is the case that there, Blinken is lying, that there is a great deal of light between the positions of the nations of Europe and the United States, and Europe knows that it will go up in nuclear, in a nuclear holocaust, since it is the host to American nuclear weapons, if there's a war between, and let us be clear, we're talking about the possibility of a nuclear war between the United States and Russia. That's what's at stake here. And as I said earlier, I don't believe the U.S. Commander-in-Chief, this is my view, the Schiller Institute's view, it's not our view that the President, the Commander-in-Chief, President Biden, wants a nuclear war with Russia, and that's what's at stake.
Mm-hmm. Well, given that that's what it's, what's at stake, maybe that's why you're having these Eastern Ukraine talks, as it's called, Donbas, in which Russia, Ukraine, Germany, and France are voicing support for what it seems like a ceasefire, maintaining a ceasefire.
Yeah.
And this kind of is like the negotiations that were called the Normandy talks. Maybe you can take us back. It sounds an awful lot like the year 2014 when you had the Ukraine crisis, in a sense, break out, and then there were these talks. What were the Normandy talks? Are they feasible? Are those talks feasible to lay groundwork for a ceasefire? This will be for Donbas. Go ahead, Donbas. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Richard Bach, get back to you.
Say Normandy, there's actually an agreement, the Minsk agreements. And the Minsk agreement was, in essence, the key parts of it, that the Eastern Ukraine republics, particularly, I believe, Donetsk and Luhansk, I don't remember if the third one was part of the agreement as to this part of the deal, they would become autonomous within, you know, the state of Ukraine. They would be autonomous governments, and this would resolve the contradiction between Kiev and the people that live in the east, in essence, because the domestic political situation in Ukraine is fragmented. It has been for, you know, a very long time. The people in the east are ethnic Russians. The people in the west are a composite of ethnic Poles, Lithuanians, you know, and others from, you know, more or less Western Europe. You have the whole, you know, historic schism between the Orthodox and the Roman Catholic world. Kind of that's a fracture line also that runs right through it. And the cultures that have evolved over many years. And by the way, most of Ukraine in both of those spheres, up until the last century for sure or so, were part of Russia for centuries. And so there are many contradictions on the ground that represent political constituencies, for example, that Zelensky has to deal with. Like Zelensky came in, he was elected as a peacemaker, he was going to resolve this dispute between the West and the East, and he got elected despite that fact, not because of it, in the West, because he was a TV star, and I think that's why he was chosen as a candidate. Once mm-hmm. he got in, he has a balancing act with these constituencies on the ground,
sure.
and there is a very strong fascist element that has a very strong shock troop on the ground constituent that he has to deal with, and the United States is using that as sort of a forward guard to intimidate Russia, and it's really dangerous the way that that's playing out. I'm just going to go to one last little point. In the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis, as it's called here, which is actually because the U.S. put missiles in Turkey in 1961, that when Kennedy did that, everybody involved, Robert McNamara, Fidel Castro, Khrushchev and his memoirs tell you that it was sheer luck that we didn't have nuclear war. We're playing now, it literally, Russian roulette, firing another shot and hoping the chamber is empty.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if Joe Biden, no matter what his intentions are, is up to it the way that John Kennedy was. And that's what we're gambling with right now.
Gambling. Russian roulette. Richard Black. Provocations, this is very similar in a sense to what the U.S. is doing when it comes to the South China Sea and the way it's provoking China. I'm not too sure what foreign policy structure or plans the U.S. has by being involved in